It's been a real pleasure to have the national meeting, our eighth in our series of national conferences, pulling together the best in program, policy, and research in our backyard here in Atlanta for a variety of reasons. First, although unfortunately the dogwoods aren't yet in bloom, the forsythias and daffodils are actually trying, and we are definitely over our drought. Second, we're pleased that not only did we have the pleasure of hearing from one of CDC's most visionary leaders, Dr. Fahey, last night, but we also have the chance for the current CDC director, Dr. Frieden, to join us not once, but twice. Finally, for those of you who haven't been to CDC's main campus in a while or ever, this is a particularly great time to go to see the new exhibit, VD, Values, Rights, and Public Health, a tour de force of striking visuals and information covering many of the issues of STD prevention through the 20th century. I'm told that there may still be some tickets tonight for the ASHA-sponsored Watsonian reception. My topic this morning, a vision of the future of STD prevention in an era of change, is a special one to me for several reasons. First, I think that if ever there was a time that the term change or crossroads was applicable to the field of STD prevention, perhaps since the advent of penicillin, this is it. Second, on a personal note, as I complete an amazing 7-year term as director of the Division of STD Prevention, it gives me a great opportunity to reflect on where we've been and where I think we should focus on going. What I'd like to do in the next 45 minutes or so is to begin by offering some reflections on STD in 2010 with a short overview of our present state, including both our most pressing challenges as well as opportunities provided by a growing array of new tools. I'll then focus primarily on what I think are really the two largest opportunities facing our field in the near future, and not coincidentally the focus of a variety of sessions in the conference. First, the possibility of health reform legislation, potentially the largest structural change in American healthcare in our professional careers. And second, a long overdue opportunity to reframe the work we do in the broader and more wellness-based approach of sexual health. These aren't the only opportunities for the future of STD prevention, but I think they're the ones that are potentially the broadest reaching with the greatest opportunity for transforming our work and our population health impact. Before I go further, and apologies for that slide at pre-advancement a few seconds ago, I want to pause for a moment and acknowledge some important losses that our field has sustained over the past 6 months with the passing of Drs. Walt Stamm and Marty Fishbein. Whether Walt's numerous contributions to our chlamydia programs or Marty's to STD-HIV prevention through the AIDS community demonstration projects and Project Respect, they are truly among the giants on whose shoulders we all stand. Let's move now to our challenges. To quickly summarize, I think they fall into three categories: our morbidity, our resources, and our priorities. Regarding our morbidity, we have issues on several fronts. While these are outlined in more detail in a variety of sessions during the conference, in a nutshell, we see that for each of the three curable infections for which the public and Congress looks to us for leadership, we have big challenges, and for each we see unacceptable disparities. Chlamydia remains at very high levels, with new records of reported cases set each year. While this is undoubtedly due to more testing, and while prevalence surveys in populations whose testing isn't dependent on healthcare seeking, such as those entering the Job Corps or those in HANES, are beginning to flatten or even decline, the national burden is clearly high. Among African Americans, rates are eightfold higher than whites, and they comprise 49% of all national infections. Gonorrhea remains the second most common notifiable infection after chlamydia, although rates continue to decrease slightly. And its disparities are even more pronounced, with a black-white rate ratio of 20 to 1 and 70% of all cases nationally in African Americans. Finally, each year over the past 7, we have moved farther from our goal of eliminating syphilis. Reported cases have continued to increase in men who have sex with men, who now make up 65% of national primary secondary syphilis cases, with data at this conference offering a methodology of determining population rates for the first time, over 45 and 70 times higher than the rates in heterosexual men and women, respectively. While black-white disparities have fallen, they are still high, now similar to those for chlamydia, with black-white rate ratios of 8 to 1 and 49% of all cases nationally occurring in African Americans. We don't have formal control programs for genital herpes, but it remains, along with HPV, one of the two most highly prevalent STD. and it is likely the sexually transmitted infection with the biggest role in enhancing HIV transmission. New data from NHANES to be presented at the conference confirms stable but high rates in persons 14 to 49, 17% overall, as well as large disparities for women and African Americans. Regarding the second challenge that we face, our resources, you know the pain in the land much better than I do. At the federal level, our funding has been eroding over the past 7 years by 27% when adjusted for inflation and population growth, as seen in the yellow line here. We are now at our lowest point since the early 1980s. As a recent ASHA study indicated, state contributions to STD prevention are variable but quite low, with only about 0.3% of state public health funding and about 19% of the estimated total coming from states. I would note that this kind of information, of course, can be incredibly useful with policymakers in a variety of circumstances. And, of course, these state funds have been under severe duress. These headlines from 2 years ago were obviously just the first crest of a tsunami of fiscal bad news, which hasn't peaked even now 2 years later. Dr. Will Wong will be presenting this very important NCSD survey on STD program capacity and infrastructure later this week. Of responding programs, 64% had experienced salary reductions and freezes, 47% furloughs or shutdown days, 25% layoffs, and 25% of the 39 programs with STD clinics had experienced clinic closures, with a severe erosion in capacity for both STD prevention and emergency response. Not surprisingly, a recently shared survey of HIV and hepatitis prevention programs by NASTAT had similar findings, with state funding decreases across the board for HIV/AIDS prevention, Ryan-White Part B, ADAP, and viral hepatitis programs. So the upshot is that serious cutbacks at the state and local level have resulted in a loss of STD prevention staff and a reduction in services, exacerbating a chronically underfunded federal situation. This will impact other prevention programs with whom STD programs collaborate, HIV testing and partner services, hepatitis B immunization, for example, in addition to their own prevention shortfalls. Now, one thing we don't have a shortage of, in addition to numbers of infections, is prevention priorities. Apart from diminished resources, the concern I've heard expressed by state and local colleagues the most consistently over the past 7 years is the explosion of priorities. How everyone's plate is overflowing, from specific infections in red to populations in orange to domains of function in yellow. This many priorities would be challenging to deal with optimal resources, and even more so in the current climate. Now, this is a sobering summary. But while it's appropriate at a national meeting like this one to take stock of our circumstances, there's much to be optimistic about. We have an increasing array of tools and prevention partnerships, with one of our big challenges, teaching old dogs how to do new tricks, as depicted here in the parable of the rotary phone and the iPhone, with the older phone saying, "When I was your age, we didn't play video games or take photos or locate things. We just did one thing, and we took our sweet time doing it." Clearly not the mantra of STD prevention in 2010. The next slide includes just a partial summary of the new tools that have become available over the past 5 years or so. Expanded use of more sensitive diagnostic tests, including testing of new sites, that is vaginal swabs, and hopefully rectal and pharyngeal swabs in the future. An array of new partner services approaches, HPV vaccines, and new communication tools. In addition, an array of new partnerships are emerging to complement our traditional partners, national coalitions like the National Chlamydia Coalition, other federal agencies such as OPA, HRSA, and CMS, and state and local prevention programs such as HIV, hepatitis, and pregnancy prevention. Now, partnerships are not a free lunch. They take time to cultivate and grow, but they can have enormous payoff with the synergisms that they create. So let me now move to the opportunities facing our field in the near future, beginning with the possibility of health reform legislation and a summary of some of the key points made by Dr. Fahey last night. First, we have an epidemic of uninsured persons in this country at 46 million as of 2010 and projected to rise to 61 million by 2020 in the absence of change. Second, lack of insurance matters for lots of reasons. According to the National Health Interview Survey, a fivefold greater likelihood of not having a regular source of care, sevenfold greater likelihood of no preventive care, 2 to 6-fold greater likelihood of having gone without needed care, and 2 to 5-fold greater likelihood of not being able to afford prescription drugs, all parameters that can obviously impact STD prevention. Third, although it has often been stated in the healthcare debate that one reason for not moving too fast is that the U.S. has the best healthcare system in the world, this is not borne out by comparisons with a variety of sentinel health outcomes among the 30 most developed countries in the world, included in the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, OECD, such as infant mortality, where we rank 25th, maternal mortality, where we rank 22nd, overall life expectancy from birth, where we rank 22nd, and even for life expectancy from age 65, at which point Medicare should reduce lack of access to health care, we rank only 9th and 10th, respectively, for men and women. And notably, in each case, when outcomes are restricted to the white and presumably more advantaged from the perspective of social determinants and healthcare access populations, our rankings are quite similar. Fourth, we experience these relatively poor outcomes despite spending far more per capita on healthcare than any of the other OECD countries. In 2007, almost $7,000, 36% higher than the next highest country. And this is a gap that's increased dramatically in the last 25 years or so. We also spend more as a percentage of our gross domestic product than any developed country. Now, in 2010, at 17.7% and projected to rise to 20.3% by 2018. We are thus at a critical point, both in terms of need and political process. This presentation would obviously have been clearer if given 4 to 6 weeks from now. And as summarized by President Obama last week, we have been debating many aspects of health reform for over a year. Much has been said, much incorrectly, probably most importantly being the notion that things aren't so bad now. As you are all aware, the crescendo has increased following the Congressional Health Reform Summit on February 25th. President Obama has asked for an up or down vote in Congress over the next several weeks. Now, for a variety of reasons, public opinion is split on proposed legislation. In this Kaiser Health Tracking Survey from February 11th through 16th, equal percents, 43%, supported and opposed reform proposals, and slightly more thought the country would be better off versus worse off if health reform passed, 45 versus 34%. For a variety of reasons, public opinion is split on proposed legislation. Top reasons for support include broader coverage, potential to lower costs, needed insurance reforms, while top reasons for opposition include fear of too big a role for government, the closed-door nature of the process, and concerns over cost. So let's talk for a few minutes about what proposed health reform will actually provide of potential value to public health. The basic structure of the proposal deals with health care coverage with three essential elements. First, expanding insurance coverage, potentially reducing the number of insured from 47 plus million to 25 million or so. This would be accomplished by expanding Medicaid eligibility and mandates for individuals and employers, supported by subsidies for low-income persons. Second, insurance market reform, largely based on insurance purchasing exchanges and providing a ban on exclusion for pre-existing conditions. And third, attempts to lower cost and enhance value, including various incentives in Medicaid and Medicare, strategies to enhance and reduce regional variations in cost, support of comparative and effectiveness research, and incentives for electronic health records, primary care, and preventive care. Regarding access, while proposed legislation won't provide fully universal access to health care, we would cut the number of uninsured by about half, the blue line depicting the Senate bill, which is the most likely to pass, starting in 2014, getting us from about 84% to 92% population coverage. From a public health perspective, what is potentially additionally impactful are measures explicitly focused on prevention. Outlined here are those in the Senate bill. First, various overarching prevention efforts, including creation of a national prevention strategy and national prevention, health promotion, and public health council to coordinate federal activities, as well as increased support for task forces to provide guidance on clinical and community preventive services. Second, new prevention programs, including a community transformation grants program, a prevention outreach program, and new initiatives such as school-based clinics, all of which is sustained with stable funding, not dependent on annual appropriations decisions. Third, and of potentially greatest importance for STD prevention, are provisions mandating full coverage in both Medicaid and private health plans of the USPSTF and ACIP recommended preventive services. This would cover screening for chlamydia in young women, gonorrhea, HIV, and syphilis testing in high-risk persons, and HPV vaccines. Fourth, new surveillance efforts would include a national data indicators institute and increased data collection to monitor disparities. Finally, there is a provision supporting a modest expansion of the public health workforce. So what could this mean for STD programs and a vision for the future of STD prevention? Before I offer my thoughts, let's touch on a real-time example of STD prevention under health care reform, the example of Massachusetts. As you know, Massachusetts was the first state to develop an approach to universal health coverage, now with more than 97% insured. Of concern to all of us in STD prevention, it was also the first state to discontinue publicly funded STD clinic services in 2009. From colleagues in Massachusetts, there were a number of early concerns and observations. It was unclear if patients would use their insurance for STD care, concern that primary care providers wouldn't have adequate training and supplies, and concerns about access to partner services. Now, I don't think we fully know yet the answers to any of these questions, but on the positive side, there are preliminary indications of increased diagnoses of chlamydia from non-STD clinic settings. As you see here from state reports of chlamydia infection from 2006 to 2009, STD clinic reports dropped by 88%, while private provider reports increased by 37%. Although the proportionate decrease from the public sector was greater, there was a substantially greater increase in chlamydia detection and reporting overall. Again, this is early data, but it's certainly consistent with the premise of substantial added value from increased healthcare access, especially if safety net sexual health services can be maintained. So overall, for the rest of us, what opportunities are likely to emerge under healthcare reform for STD prevention? I think these fall into three general categories: greater access to healthcare and thus clinical preventive services, enhancement of non-clinical prevention efforts, and leveraging opportunities within health information technology. As noted, given coverage of USPSTF and ACIP-endorsed preventive services and immunizations, STD prevention has potentially much to gain from greater access with no-cost coverage of the services. For example, for adolescent females, of 24 clinical preventive services reviewed by USPSTF, 7 have been recommended, 5 in the area of sexual health, screening for chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV, and pap tests, although as you know, there is some rethinking about the last of these for adolescents. Similarly, 1 of the 6 vaccines recommended by ACIP is the HPV vaccine. Now, importantly, let me note that this is, of course, the opportunity that is actually most in our reach, even if healthcare reform legislation does not go forward. Whether we are talking about the projected 92% with insurance company coverage, rather, or only the current 84%, the vast majority of persons in the U.S. have some access to preventive services through healthcare delivery systems. Our own national data have pointed this out to us for years, with an accelerating trend toward STD reports from primary care and other non-STD clinic sources of care. As of 2008, 83% of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis cases were reported from non-STD clinic sources, and this has occurred with relatively modest focus by CDC at the national level, and many, if not most, state STD programs on reassessing and assuring delivery of these services through healthcare delivery systems. Expanded coverage of the population and of preventive services will certainly help us in this area, but there is so much more we could and should be doing now, even though it will entail difficult choices as we refocus from what we have been doing to what we could be doing with greater population impact. So, chlamydia screening, recommended for all sexually active females under 25, becomes a great example of a potential STD prevention gain, as may be the case in Massachusetts. We know that access to health insurance is associated with higher rates of testing and lower prevalence. We have very useful longitudinal metrics on screening coverage via HEDIS, both nationally as well as for many states. And the HEDIS performance measure will be added to the accreditation set this July, which should further enhance health plan interest in their performance in this area. In addition, chlamydia screening is under consideration as a performance measure for Medicaid and SCHIP. A related example is partner services for STD, particularly expedited partner therapy for chlamydia and gonorrhea. If chlamydia and likely gonorrhea screening increase as expected, there will likely need to be more diagnoses and even greater need for partner services, enhancing the role that EPT might play. Thus, it would become an even higher priority for states whose legal environments are not permissive of EPT to work for such, and for CDC and partners to develop approaches to enhance implementation where it is permitted, such as exploration of strategies to define EPT as part of routine evidence-based personal care of the index patient, and a question we are now starting to explore with HRSA and CMS. Now, as you know, permissibility of EPT has been gradually increasing from 10 states in 2006, seen in the blue on these maps, to 22 states in 2010. Determining permissibility of EPT is a state-by-state issue, although to state the obvious, from the national perspective, we might see the biggest gains if those remaining states with the highest chlamydia morbidity, for instance, those with more than 25,000 reported cases per year, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, Virginia, and CDC's home state, Georgia, which total 22% of national chlamydia morbidity, were to achieve permissible status. A third example of a clinical service priority after healthcare reform is STD screening in HIV-positive persons. The rationale is similar to that for chlamydia. STD in HIV-positive persons is important. Syphilis continues to increase in MSM, many of whom are HIV co-infected. Compliance with national STD testing recommendations for HIV-positive persons, including syphilis, is suboptimal. And there are supportive recommendations since syphilis screening in males and females at increased risk has A-level recommendations from the USPS. Finally, we have a performance metric to track on since annual syphilis testing is now considered a Group 2 clinical performance measure by HRSA for Ryan-White supported facilities. In summary, this is a potentially productive focus at both national, CDC working with HRSA, and state and local levels, STD programs working with Ryan-White-supported clinics. Moving beyond clinical services, the second area of opportunity within health reform for public health and STD prevention is prevention enhancement through various efforts focused on community-level prevention. This has been a major focus in the realm of chronic disease prevention, including the Community Prevention and Wellness Grants, of $650 million initiated last year as part of the stimulus package to support smoking, physical activity, nutrition, and obesity. While the rationale for this part of the proposed legislation has been largely focused on chronic diseases, this is an area that those of us interested in infectious diseases should consider as well. The attributes of community-level prevention are summarized here by Dr. Ruth Finkelstein of the New York Academy of Medicine, who collaborated with the Trust for America on a project cataloging proven interventions for chronic disease. Community-level prevention focuses on promoting healthy environments and behaviors that make it easier for people to make healthy choices, such as changing community norms and supporting community empowerment, changing physical and social environments, and increasing individual knowledge and skills through health education programs. Now, very importantly, given that proposed legislation will include support for community-level prevention activities, how do we make the best case for STD prevention? As it turns out, we already have several examples. Already endorsed by the Guide to Community Preventive Services are a number of sexual health interventions, including risk reduction interventions in MSM, provider-level referral for HIV PCRS, and youth development behavioral interventions in community service settings. There are additionally three relatively new ones that have been added: comprehensive adolescent risk reduction interventions in schools or community settings, in distinction to interventions promoting only abstinence education for which data are considered insufficient. Alcohol tax is an interesting model since while the primary focus is injury prevention, part of the evidence base and rationale is reduction of STD, suggesting that as we think of how we approach community-level prevention, we should consider synergies with other prevention domains. And reminders for Pap test as well as breast and colon cancer screening. Also interesting since the very same reminders are known to work for STD prevention activities such as chlamydia screening. But we could build a bigger evidence base and enhance our opportunities within the community prevention arena. Other areas for which I think we should consider collating and gathering the evidence for STD HIV prevention include partner services via provider, EPT, and internet approaches, condom promotion and distribution programs. Consider, for example, the New York City program. Periclinical interventions, that is, those that enhance prevention in healthcare, such as social marketing programs like the GYT effort, waiting room interventions such as Safe in the City, and reminders for STD-HIV testing. And then finally, combination with chronic or injury-related approaches, reminders, alcohol taxes, etc. The reason that all of us need to think proactively about these areas is that as early as 6 months or so after passage of proposed legislation, initial proposals for use of the funds are likely to be entertained. A final area to consider is health information technology. Although not formally included in healthcare reform legislation, this is an area already jump-started under the stimulus package, so in essence, it's going on now. With the growth of health information exchanges, which are currently and will increasingly interact with electronic health records for enhancement of individual care, as well as population health. Some of these efforts are beginning to move along now. For example, CMS and the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology have worked together to develop standards for meaningful use of electronic health record data. CMS is using a three-stage process over the next several years. Stage one will consider data elements for key clinical conditions for care coordination, decision support tools, reporting quality, and public health data. Intended for use in 2011, elements have now been posted and are open for comment until March 15th. The current version includes several elements relevant to STD prevention, including childhood immunization such as hepatitis B and chlamydia screening in young females. A team at CDC has reviewed the language and identified a number of potentially useful elements, including data on sexual activity, pregnancy, adolescent vaccines, screening in HIV-positive persons for other infections. While comments at this point are unlikely to affect stage one, they could be important down the road. Thus, this is an area about which all of us need to remain aware. To summarize, developments over the last several years, now crystallizing in potential health reform legislation, is creating a number of opportunities and raising many questions. It's clear that scale-up of prevention interventions for population impact will require a more intentional focus on horizontal healthcare delivery systems than STD prevention programs have traditionally done, and greater focus on assessment, assurance, and policy than on direct services. This clearly needs to happen at the national level, as epitomized by work we're now doing with the National Chlamydia Coalition, collaboration with HRSA and community health centers, and it needs to expand. Supporting this new emphasis will require better understanding healthcare delivery systems and points of intersection and leverage, and major emphasis on partnerships, that is, with professional organizations, federal agencies, and, of course, healthcare delivery systems. And this, of course, raises many questions, a few of which include: how can we provide greater population impact by rebalancing our horizontal vertical orientation? Again, by that I mean our horizontal efforts interacting across the healthcare delivery system versus our vertical orientation of working through our traditional public health programs. What's the optimal ratio of this horizontal vertical effort? What's the role of local and state health departments in such a horizontal realignment? And how do we maintain safety net, STD, sexual health services while horizontal efforts are expanding? Now, I don't have answers for all of these questions, as well as many others likely to be equally critical, although in my wrap-up I will offer some ideas about processes to address them. I do want to alert you to a special session at noon today, a town hall meeting on STD prevention and health reform with Drs. Jeff Levy of the Trust for America and Gail Boland of the California Department of Health, serving as lead discussants. Now, let me move on to my second major focus, our long overdue opportunity to reframe the work we do in the broader and more wellness-based approach of sexual health. As for health reform, this is a theme that we've tried to highlight at this conference, and let me quickly mention the other sessions at the conference that will offer further insights into this area. Another showing of the film, Let's Talk About Sex, will take place tonight from 8 to 9:30. Tomorrow morning's plenary by Dr. Arlene Zurbriggen on achieving a more holistic norm for sexual health, with remarks by Dr. Kevin Fenton on sexual health possibilities for moving forward, as well as a mini plenary Wednesday afternoon on sexual partnering, the science, determinants, and implications, moderated by Dennis Fortenberry. Now, this is clearly not a new topic for our field or this conference. Sexual health was a major focus of the hidden epidemic discussed in detail at our 1996 conference in Tampa, which reminded us that STDs are hidden epidemics of tremendous health and economic consequences in the U.S. They are hidden from public view because many Americans are reluctant to address sexual health issues in an open way. And it has arisen in various forms at all of our conferences since. For example, in 2004, 2006, and 2008, with symposia on adolescent education and abstinence education, when the latter was at its peak of controversy. We were also reminded at Dr. Ned Hook's 2008 parent address that our disease-based STD prevention orientation, as depicted in some of the amazing graphics in our current exhibit, has been a major contributor to STD stigma, and that incorporating STD prevention into an increased emphasis on sexual health could contribute enormously to dealing with many of our issues, including our major disparities by race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. As a reminder, in this very useful summary from Dr. Hook, the stigma of STD impairs our efforts at all levels. The personal level, resulting in delays in seeking preventive health care, such as use of condoms, vaccines, and screening, delays in seeking care for perceived problems, and ineffective partner notification. At the provider level, resulting in hesitancy in seeking relevant information, such as taking sexual histories, differential testing by perceived risk, and changes to the provider-client interactions. And finally, at the population level, resulting in guilt by association and differential health care by stereotypes. Now, we have been slow to adopt a framework to better address sexual health as an official platform within the public health arena in the U.S. We had a good start in 2001 with the Surgeon General's Call to Action. The report focused on the need to promote sexual health and responsible sexual behavior across the lifespan as an essential component of overall individual health, because of its major impact on overall health of communities, emphasizing the importance of national dialogue at all levels as critical in improving population health, the priorities in homes about sexuality. During the 8 years following the release of the call to action, there was limited official consideration of sexual health in the U.S. Public discourse was dominated by discussion of the relative merits of abstinence-only education. For example, in the only State of the Union address ever to mention STD in 2004, when President Bush commented that to encourage right choices, we must be willing to confront the dangers young people face, even when they're difficult to talk about. Each year, about 3 million teenagers contract STD that can harm them or kill them or prevent them from ever becoming parents. His proposed solution was simply enhancement of the abstinence until marriage education programs. As of 2010, of course, U.S. individuals and communities are not at optimal sexual health. Let's review statistics that are all too familiar to you. Up to 19 million new STIs and 50,000 plus cases of HIV occur annually in the U.S. Associated disparities, particularly among adolescents and young adults, racial ethnic minorities, and MSM. Providers and patients have difficulty discussing sexual health. It's estimated, for example, that less than 25% of young women and men have received STD advice or counseling. Individual behaviors and experiences also reflect suboptimal sexual health. Rates of childhood sexual abuse are estimated as high as 1 in 12. 10% of teens experience dating violence, with 8% estimated to have been forced to have had sex in the past 12 months. And abortion and teen pregnancy rates currently rising. Now, some of the most staggering numbers relate to teen pregnancy. In the right-hand graph, not only have U.S. rates begun to climb over the past 2 years after 14 years of decline, but our rates are astoundingly higher than those for any other developed country, 56% higher than the U.K., over 3 times higher than Canada, and 11 times higher than in the Netherlands. In the 10 years since the release of the Surgeon General's Call to Action, there's been growing global interest in use of the framework of sexual health, with platforms adopted by a number of entities such as the World Health Organization, the Pan American Health Organization, the UK with the adoption of their National Strategy for Sexual Health, and active dialogue over the need for a national sexual and reproductive health strategy in Australia. And sexual health is certainly part of the common vernacular, as indicated by this Google search, with 37,700,000 results. So if it's time to pick up the momentum of the Surgeon General's call to action and get serious about mobilizing a sexual health framework in the U.S., let's be clear about a few things. Why use this framework? Several reasons. Health is a human right. Sexual health is a positive message, something to be sought and not avoided. Sexual health is operational over the entire life course. And sexual health provides a big tent that can enhance efficiency and effectiveness of communication and care delivery, of benefit to the public, parents, providers, and policymakers. What does this big tent include? My views are that as a minimum, it includes sexuality education, promotion and preservation of healthy sexual relationships and reproductive options, and prevention of various outcomes, STD, HIV, unplanned pregnancy, childhood sexual abuse, partner violence and sexual exploitation, and STI-related cancer. Now let me give you an example of what, for me, is a convincing use of a sexual health framework to achieve efficiency and effectiveness for at least several things in the big tent. Get Yourself Tested, GYT, was built on an MTV Kaiser Family Foundation platform of It's Your Sex Life, IYSL. It was a partnership between those two organizations and Planned Parenthood with the goals of normalizing conversation around sexual health, safety, and testing, raising awareness of STD prevalence and prevention methods, and normalizing routine STD testing. The campaign was targeted to youth, particularly young women and minorities. Messaging was focused on branding the campaign, including ease of testing, with the concept of getting kids talking comfortably about sexual health, with the idea that it might be therefore easier to broach sexual health and testing without an overt focus on scary or stigmatizing terms such as HIV or chlamydia. And that if GYT could become part of the vernacular like OMG, perhaps sexual health testing could be easier to talk about and thus normalized. Neither HIV or STD was mentioned in on-air programming, but both were mentioned on the website. At launch, GYT was among the most searched terms on Google and discussed videos on YouTube. Free and low-cost testing was proactively offered by 97 Planned Parenthood affiliates covering about 800 health centers. And comparison data from April 2009, after the launch, versus April 2008, in the previous year, was available from 10 sites. As you can see in this ecologic assessment, there were substantial increases in numbers of visits, number of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and HIV tests. And for chlamydia in males and females and gonorrhea in males, the proportionate increase in positive tests was greater than the increase in testing, indicating that the increase did not result in worried well testing. This highly successful start is going to be continued this year, extending the message to include Get Yourself Talking, with a focus on communication with partners, peers, and parents and providers. And it will run throughout the year with heightened efforts during April, STD Awareness Month. So if we're finally going to mobilize to act on the call to action in the U.S., who should be involved? Dr. Satcher had a number of suggestions. Individuals and families. Government, with its provision of services, education, surveillance, policies, laws. Non-governmental and community-based organizations, the educational sector, faith-based communities, the media and entertainment, industry, and academia. And what should our priorities be? Lots of considerations here. These are some that I think are most important. Educational programs for youth and parents, age-appropriate sexual health clinical preventive services, training in sexual health for healthcare workers, prevention efforts such as skill building for optimal personal sexual health, individual and structural interventions for building positive community-focused norms, and research to support interventions with further evidence. Surveillance, monitoring, and evaluation to include attitudes of the public, providers, and policymakers, and sexual health prevention efforts and outcomes. And then probably most importantly, to serve as a stimulus and a guide for a re-energized national dialogue on sexual health. Now, given the who and the what, I think it's instructive to consider data on adolescent attitudes about their sexual health needs. The National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy has been documenting teen attitudes about sexuality in annual surveys for many years. I think that what they indicate about who they consider helpful to the situation of information provision is interesting. For example, when asked who is more influential in your decisions about sex, adults surprisingly underestimated the role of parents and overestimated the role of media and friends. Regarding the need for more information, teens and adults were on the same page. They both said, in the vast majority of cases, we need information about both abstinence and contraception, with a minority thinking they needed information about either one or the other. Interestingly, parents were deemed by both teens and their parents, parents were a little higher, on whether they were having helpful conversations with their teens about their sex. Although both acknowledged parents could probably do a better job, they probably needed help. In this case, parents being a little more insecure maybe about how good a job they were doing. And then very interestingly, both teens and adults felt that other socially important entities in society, the media and religious leaders, should be doing more to address the consequences of sex and to help prevent teen pregnancy. So bringing this all together, the time is really now to regain momentum and catalyze national dialogue about a sexual health framework in the U.S. Our fragmented, disease-focused approach is outmoded. It enhances stigma and silence, and it's really not where youth are at. Normalizing discussions of the intrinsic role of sexuality and sexual behavior as an essential aspect of what it means to be human is essential to reduce stigma, enhance involvement by key stakeholders such as the public, providers, and policymakers, and I think really critically, to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of prevention efforts related to sexual health, and then finally, to meet youth on their own terms. Reasoning somewhat analogically, I found this vignette about meeting youth on their own terms in a recent New York Times column of interest. In a common ground type piece entitled How the GOP Goes Green, Thomas Friedman summarized Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's burgeoning interest in climate change issues like this. I've been to enough college campuses to know if you are 30 or younger, this climate issue is not a debate. It's a value. These young people grew up with recycling and a sensitivity to the environment, and the world will be better off for it. Instead of being just one more short white Republican over 50, says Graham, I am now semi-cool. There's an awareness by young people that I am doing something different. Hopefully, our already semi-cool feel can get even cooler as we get ourselves talking. So let me now wrap up with a short summary of efforts we'll be taking in the near future at CDC on these two critical topics. First, in order to regain momentum on sexual health, we will be addressing how we and our partners can promote sexual health through a public health approach at a consultation in Atlanta next month that will involve review and comments on a green paper on promoting sexual health in the U.S. and identifying strategic partnerships to advance the Surgeon General's call to action. Second, to keep our agenda moving forward on a vision for the future of STD prevention in terms of health reform and interactions with the healthcare delivery system, we've planned a series of three important consultations over the next 6 months. First, STD prevention and the healthcare delivery system to focus on how we optimize STD prevention efforts within the healthcare delivery system through a focus on assessment, assurance, and policy development. This issue that is so important to the future of our field, whether health reform legislation moves forward or not. Second, STD prevention core priorities to be conducted in collaboration with NCSD, recognizing that as our national and state programs reach out to the healthcare delivery sector, now more than ever, we need to grapple with how we rank our most critical, our very important, and our not quite as important priorities. Thirdly, given findings from the first two consultations, what are the implications for how we do STD prevention training in the 21st century? Each of these three efforts is under active development. In addition, a fourth idea under current consideration is the commissioning of an IOM report on STD prevention in the 21st century. Time to follow the three initial consultations, taking advantage of their findings to craft a larger set of recommendations about future priorities for our field. Part of the inspiration for this effort are the two influential IOM reports on the future of public health. The initial 1988 report, which outlined the key domains of assessment, assurance, and policy development rather than the historical focus of public health on service delivery, and the follow-up report 15 years later, which called for a shift from an individual to a population-based approach in practice, research, policy, and community engagement. Similar to the reconsideration of the future of public health after a 15-year interval, our vision is to update where our field should be going 14 years after the hidden epidemic. Given that the work we do in an era of diminishing public health resources, increased awareness of the importance of incorporating evidence-based clinical preventive services via electronic health records, it's essential that public health programs include coordination with the healthcare delivery system, and our focus would be to seek guidance from the IOM on how to optimize the impact of STD prevention programs through enhanced interaction with the healthcare delivery system and community-based programs. In closing, let me state, as I have for several conferences now, something that I find to be more true with each passing year. Given the high rates of STD and the nature of our prevention approaches, STD prevention really needs to be everyone's business. Now more than ever, we need to normalize our work broadly across the healthcare delivery and public health system and across society with a more inclusive sexual health approach. A comprehensive approach to STD prevention should be a shared concern among a variety of stakeholders, including public health at the national, state, and local level, healthcare providers, parents, educators, and the public. And that normalizing dialogue, services, and policies around sexual health, including STD prevention, is critical to optimally improve population health. Finally, let me close by acknowledging so many who helped in so many ways with this presentation, including multiple 2 a.m. emails with advice, suggestions, and material for this talk. If any of this made sense, it's due to these colleagues. Those parts that didn't, I will take credit for. Thank you very much, and enjoy the conference.